I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris. Bill Delaney is off today.
It's Here and Now.
It was a day of unrest in Hong Kong as tens of thousands of residents marched through the streets to protest a planned anti-subversion law, which many people say could limit free speech and religious freedoms. The demonstration was large enough to overshadow the sixth anniversary of Britain's handover of Hong Kong to China. Joining us to discuss what's happening there and why is Washington Post reporter John Pomfret, who is based in Beijing. Welcome, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Now, tell us, first of all, some of the details of this anti-subversion law that sparked the protest. What would it do exactly?
Well, it's expected to pass in a couple of days, and it will basically ban subversion, treason, sedition, and other crimes against the state, and it will also give police more powers and to carry out prison sentences for these offenses. It will ban the possession of state secrets, but it doesn't exactly define what those state secrets are. There's a lot of concern in Hong Kong that because the law is written unclearly, it will be able to be used to suppress dissent or also information that the government does not want released to the public.
Well, the Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao says the new law won't affect the rights and freedoms of people in Hong Kong. What's your take on that?
Well, it's one of these situations where if the government in Beijing had been giving people the impression that everything was fine and there were political changes in China, that some type of political reform in China, then I don't think the people in Hong Kong would be concerned. The problem is that the premier, Wen Jiabao of China, is a premier of a country that has, on a regular basis, locked up people for having dissenting opinions. They've most recently locked several people up for posting dissenting essays on the Internet.
So it's not that reassuring when people in Hong Kong hear this?
No, I think people in Hong Kong want to hear the Hong Kong government and their commitment to human rights. And when they see the Hong Kong government moving very quickly to embrace this type of a national security law, there's obviously a lot of legitimate concern. The other problem is with this law, it's not simply a human rights issue, but it's also a business issue. Because Hong Kong has made its money on the fact that it's been probably the best service center in Asia outside of Tokyo. And with a law like this, it also could be used to limit the free flow of information about companies. There's negative reports about Chinese state-run companies, which are listed very much on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. These things could fall under the category of state secrets, and that could then be a very dangerous thing for the person who wants to release that information, be it a journalist or even a financial analyst. The problem is that under the deal that Hong Kong was handed back to China, and then under the basic law that was written for the national people by the National People's Congress of China for Hong Kong, a law like this was supposed to be passed. But the problem is, for many in Hong Kong, it's been passed quite quickly, and it's been passed without what many people in Hong Kong believe is some type of due process.
And was this a peaceful protest?
Yes. And there were it's the biggest protest since June 4th, 1989. More than 350,000 people are believed to have been on the streets. Many of them are wearing black, a sign of their objection to this rule.
Well, John, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
John Pomfret reports for The Washington Post. He joined us from Beijing.
American intelligence officials reportedly believe that North Korea may be able to develop small nuclear devices capable of being carried on the head of a missile in less than a year. And the CIA claims to have identified an advanced missile testing site called Yongdak-tong, where they say North Korean researchers have conducted simulated nuclear explosions. While some wonder about the timing of the leaked report, the Bush administration has been pushing for an allied response to the North Korea threat, leading one unnamed official in today's New York Times to ask, after Iraq, who knows how good U.S. intelligence information is? Well, David Sanger broke the story in the Times. He joins us from Washington. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with this intelligence report. Tell us first about the testing site they say they have discovered.
Well, there are a few ways to explode a nuclear weapon, and one of the more advanced ways to do this is to basically compress a basketball-sized piece of plutonium or highly enriched uranium. In this particular case, they have seen a very familiar-looking testing stand with the kind of equipment you would use to bring about that kind of compression, and it's a signature of an effort to build a weapon that's small enough to fit on a missile. Now, in North Korea's case, this is significant because, of course, they have a very advanced missile program of both medium and long-range missiles that they not only have in their own arsenal, but that they sell around the world.
And this would be combining the nuclear capability with the missile capability.
That's right.
Well, wasn't the previous thinking that North Korea didn't have enough internal expertise and enough outside help to make such a nuclear weapon?
That's right. The CIA estimate has long been that they probably made one or two crude nuclear weapons in the late 80s or early 90s before the Clinton administration reached a nuclear freeze agreement on their main nuclear facility. The thinking was, though, that they did not have the technology to make something small, and this would suggest that they got some outside help. Now, where they got that outside help, we don't know, but we do know that after the Cold War ended, there were an awful lot of nuclear scientists who were unemployed and wandering the globe looking for work. Mm.
And we also know, to remind listeners, that North Korea had international inspectors until late last year when North Korea evicted them. And those inspectors had, as you write, been guarding a collection of 8,000 spent nuclear fuel rods.
Right. We don't know where those fuel rods are now. We know that American satellites saw what appeared to be some of them being moved from the storage area where they'd been during the inspection time. But it's not entirely clear where they've all gone to.
Well, now you write about this site that the CIA claims to be seeing. But they say that they don't have enough evidence that there's been processing of plutonium because, as you write, U.S. intelligence hasn't been sniffing the telltale krypton gas that's released when nuclear fuel rods are converted into weapons-grade plutonium. How do you sniff for krypton gas in a country you can't get into?
Very carefully. It's difficult because this process does let off trace amounts of this gas. But because they are not in the country itself, they have to rely on either friendly nations that have embassies in the country, sniffing it in Pyongyang, the capital, or hoping to sniff it along the borders or out near the ocean. This is a difficult process because there is krypton gas also in the background from other activity that takes place in Japan and elsewhere, civilian nuclear activity. So figuring this out is no easy trick.
Mm. And David, how much do you trust this intelligence? You speak to officials who don't trust it.
You know, in this environment, nobody trusts intelligence. I mean, the fact of the matter is that even before Iraq happened, this is the hardest kind of information to collect. You can have three different groups of analysts looking at the same set of data and coming to three different conclusions, all of them equally valid. So it's one thing to have the photograph. It's another thing to interpret what it means or how far along they've gotten. And Iraq was a lesson to us all that you can see infrastructure, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the expertise is there to get the job done.
Mm. David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times.
Officials in Fallujah are still counting the dead at the site of a mosque where a massive explosion went off late last night. Dozens of Iraqis gathered there to chant anti-American slogans shortly afterwards, and today brought grenade attacks on two U.S. military vehicles. The explosion and the attacks come on the heels of Sunday's assassination of Abdullah al-Khattab in Tikrit. He is the leader of Saddam Hussein's tribe, Bani al-Nasiri. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Jason Burke, reporter for The Observer in London. And Jason, what's the word you're hearing as to what caused this explosion?
We think, and to be honest, it looks fairly likely, that it was caused by some munitions or possibly some bomb-making equipment that were being stored in the mosque. It was apparently an outhouse that exploded, or a cinder block building inside the compound, but not part of the main mosque itself. immediately local people started blaming American missile strikes. Personally, I don't think those claims should be taken too seriously. We've heard them on a number of occasions, and they haven't proven to be true.
Can you help give us some perspective on this assassination of al-Khattab? I understand that he is someone who had disavowed Saddam Hussein. So what does that tell us as to who might be behind this assassination?
There was a lot of reporting early on in the conflict about how tribal Iraq was, and that's absolutely true. What people failed to realize early on was that the tribes are by no means homogenous politically, and you have a whole range of conflicting interests within them. Quite what was behind the assassination isn't clear as yet. It may have been an internecine tribal battle. It may have been because the victim had disavowed, as you say, Saddam and the regime, and it was Ba'athist loyalists who were behind it. There's a fair amount of killing going on. Quite who's doing it is pretty unclear.
We've heard from Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld that all of these various attacks on U.S. troops over the last several weeks are isolated and criminal, as he describes them, rather than terrorist activities. But as you've reported, there is some evidence that these attacks maybe part of a plan that was put in place even before the invasion.
The reason I think we need to be careful about it is blaming a range of Ba'athist Saddam Hussein loyalists with a coherent plan to disrupt coalition operations here is something that Mr. Rumsfeld and those alongside him are very keen to do. If you can say that that's going on, then it makes it far less likely that you've got a growing wave of discontent among the Iraqi people.
Well, you're there on the ground. What's your sense, that this is the sort of normal aftermath of a war, or does it seem to be coordinated in some way and much less random than perhaps it's being portrayed?
No, I think it's genuinely pretty random. What's important is what they're doing, because though militarily they're insignificant, what they're doing, though, is making the process of reconstruction very, very difficult. And they're the grassroots issues that people here are getting very, very angry about. That anger is causing problems, and it will only grow. So those who are conducting these military operations are doing something that do have a major social and political interest. And that, I think, is interesting and one to watch in the coming weeks and months.
Well, Jason, thanks very much for giving us the bigger picture on this.
No, thank you.
Jason Burke is reporter for The Observer in London.
Just ahead, doctors confirm what patients suspected. Chemotherapy can affect your thinking.
And later in the program, civil liberties in the age of email.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
There may be few things worse than having a medical condition that doesn't officially exist. For a long time, that was the situation of patients who complained of memory problems and fuzzy thinking after cancer chemotherapy. The complaint was often dismissed as imaginary or a symptom of anxiety or depression. But now, some doctors are beginning to recognize and study the phenomenon known as chemobrain. Here now is regular health columnist Judy Foreman joins us in the studio to tell us more. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, but this must be terrible. I mean, it must be discombobulating enough to be dealing with the fact that you have cancer.
That's right.
And then to think that, and you know what, I'm getting chemotherapy that's supposed to help, but I can't think straight.
That's exactly right. It really, and it spooks people out because the doctors haven't known until recently enough about it to kind of warn you. So it kind of hits out of the blue.
Right. And what are the symptoms?
Well, just as you said, kind of fuzzy thinking, memory problems. I've talked to people who say they've had a conversation then have completely forgotten it 10 minutes later. You know, of course, we all sort of jokingly say this happens to us, but it really happens to some people consistently right after every chemo treatment.
Well, and then people go in and out of chemo treatments. In other words, they go into a form of recovery. So is that how they know? Is that how they feel they can pinpoint that it's the chemotherapy?
Well, actually, it's really hard to know whether to pinpoint it as chemotherapy or not. The patients are convinced it is. The doctors are just beginning to study it. And one of the problems is they don't really study people before they get chemo and then the same people after. They sort of compare people who've had chemo to healthy people who have not had chemo and get the differences that way. But usually the people who've had chemo do a bit worse on the cognitive tests.
And there have been some studies. Tell us more about
them. They're very interesting. For one thing, they're mostly on women with breast cancer. And I think that that's because women have gotten so good about kind of being the squeaky wheel and saying, this is going on. We want to get this tested. They have found, some Dutch studies in particular, have found that after chemo, women do worse than with breast cancer than women who have breast cancer but didn't get chemo. There's a big sort of group difference in average.
You mean in memory, as far as
in memory and yeah. You know, there's a whole bunch of paper and pencil tests they call neuropsych tests to see how your cognitive functioning is doing. And you know, you talking to me might not think there was anything different, but the person themselves really knows that their mind isn't working quite right.
Mm-hmm. So why isn't that study definitive?
Because ideally you would like to take the same people before chemo, then during, and then after. Mm. There's also a study at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center in New Hampshire about this, where they looked not just at breast cancer people, but also at people with lymphoma. And so there were men in this one as well. And they looked at the people who had had just surgery and radiation for their cancer, which was very localized treatment, compared to the people with the same cancers who got systemic treatment, which is chemo, which goes through your whole body. And the ones who had gotten the chemo did worse on these cognitive tests than the ones who had only gotten surgery and radiation, again, suggesting there's something going on.
Is it really all that surprising, though, because these chemotherapy drugs that kill cancer and can also kill blood cells and sometimes cause nerve damage, these are very powerful drugs.
They are. The reason it's surprising, at least to oncologists, is that these drugs are very big molecules, and they're not supposed to be able to get into the brain. There's this membrane that separates the brain from the rest of the circulation called the blood-brain barrier, and these molecules are thought to be too big to get in. In fact, that's a problem because a lot of people have cancer that spreads to the brain, and if these molecules got in better, it'd be easier to treat spreading cancer.
Brain cancer.
The reason that people still think that this is associated with chemo is that chemotherapy can make your cells secrete these chemicals called cytokines, which do get into the brain and do cause cognitive deficits, at least temporarily. Mm. So that's why they think it may be connected.
So what are we to take from all of this? I mean, obviously people who feel they need their chemotherapy shouldn't be considering not doing it because of chemobrain.
That's a really good question, and that's completely right. I mean, this is a side effect, and it is a problem for people, but on the scheme of things, if you need the chemo, you're probably much better off getting the chemo than skipping it because of this.
Well, Judy, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Judy Foreman is Here and Now's regular health commentator. To read her syndicated medical column, visit our website, here-now.org.
A quarter of a million Americans are infected with HIV but don't know it. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which this week begins a major new effort to expand HIV screening. The CDC now has a rapid HIV test, much like a home pregnancy kit, that health workers hope will help them reach the people who are most at risk. Dr. Robert Janssen joins us now from the CDC in Atlanta. Hello, doctor.
Hello.
I have to wonder, first of all, if you haven't been able to test everyone, how do you know that there are 250,000 people who don't know that they're infected with HIV?
Well, they're estimates based on the number of people living with AIDS and based on a surveillance system that collects information on people diagnosed with HIV in some of the states across the country.
And how do you think this new kit is going to be more effective in reaching some of these people?
Well, the new simple rapid test is very exciting because it can give a test result in about 20 minutes. We're trying to reach the people at very highest risk for HIV infection, since those are the people who are most likely to be living with HIV and don't know it. One of the important ways to do that is to do testing and outreach, going into the communities where people at high risk for HIV are living and providing access to testing in those areas. In addition, we think since about 25% of people living with HIV are estimated to go through a correctional facility over a year, that we can offer this rapid test in jails where people may be held for only 48 hours, get a preliminary test result back, and then on discharge get them to medical care.
How much of a problem is it, though, where people get the standard test and then just don't even come back to get their results?
One of the things that we're excited about with respect to the rapid test is about 30% of people who get tested through CDC-funded test sites who test positive don't come back to get their test result. We have done studies in the past that show when a rapid test is used, people were much more likely to come back and get their test results.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Janssen.
You're welcome.
Dr. Robert Janssen is with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, there are known knowns. There are also unknown unknowns. The words of Donald Rumsfeld, and they are poetry to some.
That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, watch what you write in those subject lines. Critics say the government use of email to track down terrorists could be a slippery slope, but supporters disagree.
The idea that there's this monitoring of email is rather absurd. It would certainly not be a useful law enforcement technique.
And Here and Now goes to the drive-in.
So I would imagine when Jaws came out, it was pretty popular.
Gosh, that was unbelievable. Even in the fog, we filled the theater.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. Pope John Paul II has named Palm Beach, Florida Bishop Sean Patrick O'Malley to lead the Boston Archdiocese. O'Malley spoke this morning, vowing to bring closure to the clergy sex abuse scandal that has rocked the Catholic Church in Boston.
Settlements are not hush money or extortion or anything other than the rightful indemnification of persons who have suffered gravely at the hands of a priest. If there is a moral obligation, we must step up to the plate. People's lives are more important than money.
O'Malley is credited with helping clean up Catholic diocese in Fall River, Massachusetts, and in Palm Beach following clergy sex abuse scandals. He plans to meet with some abuse victims this afternoon in Boston. There's been more violence in Iraq. Witnesses say two separate attacks on U.S. troops around Baghdad have left an unknown number of casualties. And in Fallujah, an explosion at a mosque killed at least 10 Iraqis. A new poll shows more than half of Americans surveyed believe the U.S. has found clear evidence that Saddam Hussein was working with al-Qaeda terrorists. The University of Maryland report also says that 70% of those surveyed believe the Bush administration implied that Iraq and Saddam Hussein were involved in the September 11th attacks. The poll questioned more than 1,000 adults. Israeli and Palestinian leaders are renewing their support for the U.S.-backed Roadmap to Peace as they meet for their third summit in 6 weeks. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says he will make every effort to reach an agreement that will lead to peace and security. His Palestinian counterpart, Mahmoud Abbas, says every day without an agreement is an opportunity lost. Comedian Buddy Hackett has died. Hackett's 50-year career in show business included appearances in nightclubs, Broadway shows, and on television and in movies. Hackett is best known for his movie roles in The Music Man, The Love Bug, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, and even The Little Mermaid.
Humans use these little babies to straighten their hair out. See, just a little twirl here and a yank down, boy, oh, like. Yeah, I got an aesthetically pleasing configuration of hair that humans go nuts over.
Buddy Hackett was 78 years old. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are down. The Dow is down 89 points at 88.96, and the NASDAQ is down 16 at 16.07. It's 33 minutes past the hour.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney is away.
It's Here and Now.
This week, as Americans celebrate Independence Day, we're taking a week-long look at civil liberties. Today in Part 2, new rules under the USA Patriot Act for search and seizure using phone lines. Before the Internet came along, investigators could use a limited type of search called a pen register to find out what numbers were dialed to or from a telephone, but they couldn't listen in to the content of the call. Well, pen registers are still used, but when it comes to email, remember, your computer uses a phone line, what's considered content, and how often is it being searched? Joining us on the line to discuss this is Tim Edgar, Legislative Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. Hi, Tim.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, first of all, why the phrase pen registers? What does that mean?
Well, it used to be back in the old era of the telephone that there was a physical device that was called a pen register because it registered the pen pricks that makes a phone number, the numbers that you dial on a telephone or that you receive on your phone when you receive phone numbers.
I see. Well, how often are these modern-day pen registers used to monitor email?
Well, they can be used basically in any investigation under the Patriot Act now, and the technology is very easy for monitoring communications on the Internet, but the legal questions are very difficult.
And what, why is this a problem for you?
Well, you know, your communications, your private communications, doesn't matter what whether you're using a telephone, a cell phone, the Internet, or a fax machine, should be your private communications. And the government should not be able to look at those communications unless they've shown that you're suspected of involvement in a crime and can get a court order based on probable cause.
With emails, isn't there much more you can find out in the addressing information, for instance, the content that's typed in the subject line?
That's right. It's just a much more detailed amount of information that's in the header of an email than just the telephone number that that I dial. And with web browsing, it's even worse. You're looking at the search terms that they've entered. You're looking at a whole host of information that's revealed by the addressing information in an Internet browser.
Well, Mark Corallo of the Justice Department, and we'll be speaking to him in a moment, says this isn't a blank check, that they do have probable cause, that no one has become the subject of an investigation because of an email they've sent. It's the other way around.
Well, I know that Mark's been saying that in a lot of communications all over the country, and it's just not true. The Patriot Act reduces probable cause for Internet surveillance and for record searches. And also, those kinds of searches and monitoring, electronic monitoring, were always legal in criminal investigations before the Patriot Act. The real problem with the Patriot Act is that it extends to the Internet these kind of monitoring powers that don't require probable cause, but just require a government official to say that they're relevant to their investigation. And that's a very low standard that doesn't protect people's privacy. Mm. So I think that it's important for us to ensure that as we update our laws to reflect changing technology, we also update our constitutional protections and privacy protections. And that's something we haven't done with the Patriot Act.
Mm. Well, Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
Tim Edgar is legislative counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. Well, as promised, we turn now to Mark Corallo, spokesperson for the Department of Justice in Washington. And Mark, first of all, how often are pen registers used to search email?
Well, I really couldn't say how often. The difference that the Patriot Act made was that it simply streamlined the process for obtaining pen registers under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. But it does preserve the existing court order requirement. So the idea that, you know, the FBI can just go out there and unilaterally install these things is not true, even though the Constitution, as upheld by the Supreme Court, does not require a court order. In Smith v. Maryland in 1979, basically they ruled that a person has no legitimate expectation of privacy and information he voluntarily turns over to third parties, such as the phone company or your Internet provider.
Well, that may be true, but you know that a lot of people will be repelled by the thought that their content line and their Internet searches might be trailed by the government.
The idea that there's this monitoring of email, these, you know, literally probably trillions of emails flying across cyberspace, is rather absurd. It would certainly not be a useful law enforcement technique. What is done is, in an investigation, someone who is suspected of being a member of a terrorist group may have their email, and not the content of the email, just the address. They may have those addresses turned over to the communications. I don't think that's unreasonable, since that's been long used in regular law enforcement.
Well, then we should say, as we said earlier, that the address contains the subject line, which often contains content, although I hardly think that anyone's going to say, hey, in this email, let's talk about our plans to perform a terrorist act. But you heard Tim Edgar say that he feels you are not using probable cause in going after these emails.
Well, you know, Tim and his friends at the ACLU have misstated what the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act requires over and over again. You have to convince a federal judge that the targets of your investigation are members of terrorist organizations or foreign spies. Now, I don't think that you or I or any of the other, you know, 99.99999% of the American people fall into those categories.
Mark, can you give us an example of a case in which it would merit the FBI reading somebody's email subject lines and knowing who they sent it to?
Yeah, sure. If you have a subject in an investigation and you were able to find out that he is emailing someone in Afghanistan, And that person in Afghanistan that's receiving it is on our known terrorist watch list. That would certainly be a tip-off, wouldn't it?
Mm. Of course, we didn't know these people.
That's right.
The specific ones even existed before 9/11.
Right, and that's a lot of what the Patriot Act did. You know, we've had a lot of criticism about not being able to connect the dots. Well, a lot of that was because law enforcement and the intelligence community could not share information.
So people should know that your internet service provider has a record of your emails and who you've sent them to, and they may turn them over to the FBI.
Well, right. I mean, again, this is just like the phone company has records of your phone conversations.
And, Mark, you're saying that the FBI never goes and gets the email list from AOL, for instance, without getting a ruling from a judge.
That's correct. I mean, they're prohibited.
Well, Mark, thank you.
You are so welcome.
Mark Corallo is a spokesperson for the Department of Justice. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
Our series on civil liberties continues tomorrow, when we'll be looking into why some librarians are so concerned about the USA Patriot Act.
And still to come, they may be going the way of the dinosaur, but business is brisk at one beloved drive-in on Cape Cod.
You're listening to Here and Now.
This 4th of July, some towns around the country will hear the chirp of crickets instead of the crackle of fireworks. The deadline for meeting requirements of the new Federal Safe Explosives Act was May 24th, and many small towns didn't even know about it. Now they're finding out, and it's way too late for the rigorous background check and permit from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Well, joining us on the line is Dick Hardy. He owns Aerial FX, a fireworks company in St. Joseph, Missouri. Hi, Dick.
Hello.
Well, first of all, what are you hearing from people?
Well, we've had a number of customers, not only cities, but individuals who were hoping to purchase this year, who have purchased in the past, that were not able to buy because of the new Homeland Security regulations.
And I hear you tried to get the word out. You had classes that to help people get through the application process?
Yes, we did. Back on the 1st of March, we had approximately 120 people in, and it was called Get Legal, and it was what they were going to have to do to deal with the new federal legislation.
What's some of that? What does it entail?
It's a pretty healthy background check. No felonies. You can't be an alien. They get pretty deep into your background.
You get the whole fingerprint and everything. And we hear that some, you know, church groups or Rotary clubs just canceled because they couldn't find people who wanted to go in and have fingerprints, or they didn't know about it.
Absolutely true. A number of folks have, you know, that have had shows in the past, especially a couple Lions clubs here in the Midwest that we're very familiar with. They've been doing shows for years. They weren't aware of it, and they couldn't have their party.
Right. I understand that originally there was a problem with transportation of the fireworks as well. Some of the railroad lines didn't want their workers to take the background checks, and the workers didn't want to take them either. I know that's all been fixed, but how did that impact you initially?
Well, initially it ended up costing us a great deal of money to get the fireworks transported to us. Basically, it took us from about $600 shipping fee up to $4,000. Something else that I was greatly concerned about was the fact that we was taking explosives off the rail lines and running them over the highways now. That worried me a little bit.
Right, a little more dangerous maybe. We understand that roadside stands can still sell the smaller sized fireworks, and large cities are exempt from a lot of these issues because they usually hire professional companies. I don't know, maybe there's an assumption that those people have all been vetted. What do you think the effect of this is going to be, Dick?
It's cost us, I'm going to say, 18 to 20% of our business, and a good deal of that was because people didn't know or people didn't want to go through that background check. I recently heard an article where one of the manufacturers of fireworks, of this is Consumer Fireworks, sent a great deal of fireworks over to Afghanistan for our guys so they could have that. And the article came back that, well, we can do it in Afghanistan, but we can't do it in Iowa. So.
Well, Dick, I wish you a happy 4th of July nonetheless.
Well, thank you so much.
Dick Hardy owns Aerial FX Fireworks in St. Joseph, Missouri. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Ah, summer on Cape Cod. Sand, sea, and the drive-in. Once an important part of the summer scene, drive-in theaters have all but disappeared. But one such theater, the Wellfleet Drive-In, is still going strong. Built in 1957 by local resident Don Gents, its giant outdoor screen is a landmark on the Cape. Over the years, Mr. Gents added a mini golf course, a restaurant, a flea market, and in 1986, an indoor cinema with four screens. Don Gents died in 1998, leaving the complex to longtime employees Eleanor Hazen and John Vincent Jr. In an encore performance, we bring you producer Andrea Shea's tour of the drive-in. It began in Eleanor Hazen's Oldsmobile Ragtop.
Nice car.
Thank you.
Great to go to the driving in.
Yeah, convertible.
Beautiful day for a convertible.
Yeah.
Little 50s music in the background.
This is great.
I cried a tear for nobody but you. I'll be
the ticket booth. Like the right side or the left side of the field?
Oh, God, I don't know. It's been a long time since I've been in a drive-in, so...
The left side seems to be the most popular. You don't get any of the lights from the roadway.
So how many speakers are there here?
Around 700, I think 710 at one time, but every once in a while something happens. You might lose a speaker, like over there, when we put the... handicapped bathroom in, we kind of lost a space, so. But most of them are still here. There's the screen. How big is it, John?
100 feet, 6 inches by 44 feet.
Pick up my water, I'm putting down. Oh, baby, I'm still a handyman.
So, Eleanor, the first time you came here was in 1957 when the theater was open.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think I started helping in the restaurant, and then I ran the dairy bar, and then I ran the restaurant, and
then I just about did everything here. The only thing I haven't done is a projection booth. I haven't even tried it, actually.
And what was it like? I mean, you were here pretty much for the first season, for the first summer.
Yeah.
Do you remember what film was the first film you saw here?
No, I can't remember that. I know the first big film when they filled the place was Bridge Over the River Kwai, and I did see that here.
I tell you, gentlemen, we have a problem on our hands. Thanks to the Japanese, we now command a rabble. There's no order, no discipline. Our task is to rebuild the battalion.
Yes, sir.
It isn't going to be easy, but fortunately we have the means at hand. The bridge.
The bridge, sir?
The bridge.
So what was the scene like, back then when the Bridge on the River Kwai was playing that night?
Lots of kids, food, lines going into the snack bar. It was crazy because it was so inexpensive then. Everybody went, and campers love the drive-in. People in little cottages, they'd come here every night if we had a different movie.
Right, and drive-ins first came to the United States or started being built in the 1930s, but it was in the 50s that they really exploded.
That's when they really exploded, you're right.
Now, John, you're the president and the general manager. How long have you been here?
I've been here for 13 years, since 1987. I was 19.
Teen angel, teen angel.
How has the drive-in experience changed here at the Wellfleet Drive-In over the years, as far as the audiences go or the demands on you as the president and vice president?
Well, I think people want the new things, but they want the old things, too. They love having the speakers, yet they like having the Dolby sound on their Dolby radios in their cars, and yet they love coming in, listening to the popcorn pop, and the families all come. People will make it at least once a year because it's the experience.
So I would imagine when Jaws came out, it was pretty popular.
Oh, gosh, that was unbelievable. Even in the fog, we filled the theater. We would fill it so quickly that back then we had a couple of cops on duty, and they would put horses across the front of the property because it just was so crazy. But I can remember coming through the fog and one woman saying, I think I like it better in the fog.
What we are dealing with here is a perfect engine, an eating machine.
He's gone under the boat. I think he's gone under the boat.
Fire, you son of a...
Can you tell me a little bit more about the history of the screen? I mean, this is the original screen, right?
Yes, it was built in 1957, and it has been through 10 hurricanes and countless nor'easters, and it's from the top of it you can see both the bay and the ocean. In this narrow part of Cape Cod, it really does take the brunt of the salt air and everything else. It costs us quite a bit to maintain, too, but it's our mecca. It's our symbol, I suppose.
Dream.
It seems, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there is a bit of a revival of interest in drive-in movie theaters. Have you seen that here?
It bottomed out in the late 80s. When I started here, those were some of the worst years that the drive-in had seen. That was when the quickest downfall was. I think in 1985, there was 130 drive-ins in Massachusetts. By 1990, there were only 60. And then by 93, there were 6. So you saw a rapid disappearance, mostly due to the increase of the value of the land.
The film companies really did more to get rid of the drive-ins than anything, I'd say. They wouldn't give them the films. They like the multiplexes because they can send a film in, they leave it there for 3 months, then they don't have to hire those people that are constantly taking care of booking and switching around. Well, you obviously couldn't do that in a drive-in. That would have to be some kind of cult film, but it just wouldn't work.
Are there some people that are just drive-in fanatics?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they love it.
There's a fan club that started in 1993, based out of Maryland. It's the Drive-In Theater Fanatic Fan Club, and it's quite an organization.
When they love it, they really love it.
My baby loved the Western movies. My baby loved the Western movies.
So now, how old is the projector that you're using?
They're original, 1957. They're built very well back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, that even a lot of the newer multiplexes have rebuilt or refurbished projectors that were taken out of drive-ins or single-screen theaters. That's what you need, reliability. You can't have, in the middle of your show, the movie stop.
Can we go check it out?
Sure.
This is the heart of the Wellfleet Drive-In. Well, look at these great old machines.
Oh my God,
wow, it's huge. It's about, what, 6 feet? Oh, we're over 6 feet tall.
Yeah. Uses about 8,000 watts per projector, so quite a bit of light going on the screen.
So, Eleanor, do you ever feel like you're kind of the keeper of the torch, or you're keeping the flame of the drive-in alive?
Yeah, I think so. It's funny, you know. I mean, Mr. Jentz loved it. I mean, he just loved the drive-in, and I guess he kind of got that into John and myself, so we don't want to ever close. We're planning to just keep fixing up and getting down the mortgage. We try to do anything we can think of to help in the whole area, because we have 26 acres here, so it's not just one thing, but this is pretty much our leading thing.
Every time I have a date, there's only one place to go, that's to the drive-in. It's such a groovy place to talk and maybe watch a show down at the drive-in.
Eleanor Hazen and John Vincent Jr. spoke with Here and Now producer Andrea Shea. The Wellfleet Drive-In is open through Columbus Day.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young, saying so long, Mitch Wortlieb, and congratulations to the new morning guy at Vermont Public Radio.
The rest of you, join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink, technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.